During this past National Non-Smoking Week, many people have called up radio talk shows to talk about their successes and their failures when they tried to quit. It seems that in the United States, at least, making the effort to quit has been made just a little bit more difficult. A Harvard School of Public Health's report shows that cigarette manufacturers have steadily increased the levels of nicotine in their cigarettes. This independent analysis is based on data submitted to the Massachusetts Department of Public Health by the manufacturers. Dr. Tony Phillips is professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of British Columbia and advisory board member of the Canadian Institutes of Health Research in the Institutes of Neurosciences, Mental Health and Addiction, and founding member of Neuroscience Canada. His CIHR-based research focuses on brain behavior function and the neural basis of addiction, including tobacco. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Barry.
How many people smoke tobacco-related products in Canada today?
Oh, I think it's about 20% of the population.
Why do people become addicted to nicotine? And the question I'm asking is more along the lines of, what's the mechanism that leads to this condition? What is it in the brain itself that leads some people to be having more of an addiction in some cases than others, and why it's easier for some people to quit than others?
Well, you put your finger on the most important factor, and that, of course, is individual differences. Every one of us is a different individual, both psychologically and physiologically, and so there are going to be genetic factors in our background, but also we're learning that the environment that we grow up in has an imprint on our psychology and our physiology. And most excitingly, really, there's an interaction between environment and genes. So certain life traumas may actually cause us to express different genetic code than if we had not suffered that life trauma. So all of these are going to be predisposing factors. Those of us who are trying to understand how drugs like nicotine and even, more aggressive drugs like cocaine and heroin, how they affect the brain, what we've learned is that these drugs really, they hitchhike on the natural circuits of the brain that are required for normal motivation. These are the circuits in the brain that allow us to give us feedback about when we're pursuing the right course of action. When we've got the right amount of food, the right kind of food we need, when we've got sufficient fluid in our bodies, all of these physiological circuits are essential for life. And one of the main brain neurotransmitters is dopamine, and it seems to play a very important role in these physiological drive states and the signals of reward that we get when we're obtaining what we need for survival. And so a drug like nicotine has a direct effect on dopamine by the drug itself. Nicotine is actually a mimic of a natural receptor in the brain called a nicotinic receptor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of the broader acetylcholine family of brain transmitters. And this nicotine activates a very selective receptor, which in turn has an immediate action on the firing rate of dopamine, and this in turn causes the excitation of these motivational systems. And because the drug is powerful and there isn't a natural feedback in the body to prevent its action, it actually drives these motivational circuits far more aggressively than would, the thoughts of even something as attractive as a bar of chocolate or, a warm cup of cocoa.
Are there any short or long-term consequences on the actual physical structure of the brain, that's addicted to nicotine? There are, there is a concept of brain plasticity that it'll adapt to various other traumas or stressors on it. Does the same thing happen with nicotine, that the longer you smoke or dose-related responses to nicotine, the more it has a physical impact on the structure of the brain?
Yeah. Let's begin with the point that you led off with from the New England Journal study.
Sure.
Journal of Medicine study, in which I think it was the content of nicotine had gone up 1% to 11%, I think it was.
Yes, it was about 1.3% a year over 7 years or something,
right.
So it was 11% increase over that time.
Over that time, right. So one thing we know for sure, that's just a classical dose response curve. So the more of a drug you give up to a certain point, the more activity that has on a physiological system. And so by increasing the concentration of nicotine by, let's just call it 10%, these dopamine systems are going to be more activated than they would at a lower dose. And that, in turn, is going to cause this dopamine to be released more aggressively. And that's just step one. The second thing, to answer your direct question, is how does the brain capture this repeated experience with a drug like nicotine? Well, what we now know is that the key element is not so much the receptor that nicotine is acting upon, although that can change. It can adapt to nicotine itself. But the dopamine system, at its terminal region, which innervates really critical forebrain areas like the frontal lobes of the brain, the amygdala, the hippocampus, other circuits that are responsible for motor habits, these circuits, which are called, the ends of which are called synapses, they're highly adaptive. And if those synapses get activated repeatedly, especially in a unique environment, then two things happen. One is that the synapses become the same amount of drug, so that 11% increase given repeatedly might have a further increment, so that the eventual impact of that 11% could actually be 20%, because it sensitizes these synaptic terminals in these critical brain regions. And that's how we think the memory of the effect of the drug is etched into the brain.
I guess now there was also yesterday released in the current edition of Science, and this goes along to what you've been mentioning about certain areas of the brain and how it responds. This was a neuroscientist at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, is Dr. Antoine Becerra. They looked at 19 people, it was a small study, but who had strokes, and that they had damage to the insula of the brain. And those people that had damage to the insula had lost any desire to smoke. These were people who had previously smoked. Those who had strokes in that area wasn't affected, didn't have that same easiness to stop smoking. So it brings home the point that there are regions in the brain that as we learn and as we go along, we'll understand how everything interconnects and perhaps be able to help people quit smoking as well.
Yeah, that's a very important study. Just coincidentally, Dr. Becerra is Canadian. He went to Iowa, then now he's a professor in California. And he's been doing some wonderful work on the sort of natural experiments in which people who unfortunately suffer from brain damage, such as as results from a stroke, to learn more about how the brain adapts to a stroke, many of these brave people volunteer to be subject in experiments. And so this is one of his experiments in which he looks at people who have a very restricted insult to the insular region of the brain, which is in the forebrain of the human brain. And he can obviously do a magnetic resonance imaging study to confirm that damage is restricted to that part of the brain. And then he can look to see how the behavior of the person or the psychology has changed. And so by looking, there were animal studies that preceded that set of experiments that suggested that this part of the brain and the anterior cingulate as well might be involved in the desire, the intense motivation to use a drug like nicotine. And so nature has provided a natural experiment in which that part of the brain has been damaged, and then you can show that the desire has been changed. It shows you how powerfully localized things like, the desire to smoke a cigarette could be located in the human brain.
And I guess my final question to you is what further research is ongoing? What areas do you plan to look at? And how do you believe it will be incorporated into strategies over the long term for people to help them try to stop smoking?
Okay. One thing that would be very helpful would be to try to find the subset of individuals who are more vulnerable. The fortunate thing about smoking is that not everybody becomes addicted. And then, as you said in your intro, some of those who do are able to shake the habit. But there seems to be a subset of about one-third of the people who do take up serious smoking who do become addicted. And so it would be nice if we could have a biomarker so that we could tell ahead of time that some individual might be more or less susceptible. And then, to me, the problem with cigarette smoking, in addition to the addiction, of course, is the terrible effect that all of the other carcinogens in the smoke have on your lungs and your heart. You know, so you wouldn't want to just say, well, you know, you're not going to be habitually a smoker, but you still could have a health risk, so don't take it the wrong way. But I think some way of identifying vulnerable people would be very, very helpful. The other thing that's going to happen is that when we do find, and I'm quite sure we are going to find, drugs or biological interventions that will help, I also think that there isn't going to be a magic pill. I mean, I don't think we're going to be able to target something to the insula, shut it down selectively so that somebody loses a complete desire. I think what we're going to have are therapies that combine cognitive and behavioral advice, you know, from counselors, coupled hopefully with a drug that will greatly lessen the craving or the urge to smoke a cigarette. And here I think one of the most promising, it's almost science fiction-like, it's the development of a vaccine so that when the nicotine molecule enters the bloodstream, by appropriate vaccination procedures, that people are trying now to develop antibodies that would sort of mop up that nicotine before it crosses from the blood into the brain and then produces its effects on brain chemicals, which are really the neurochemical basis of addiction. So these are under active human trials right now, and also vaccines are being developed for cocaine. So that's, I think, a very promising line. The other thing that my colleagues and I are working on, we're trying to understand that process of sensitization that I spoke about earlier. And we've found some highly selective drugs which can prevent sensitization from taking place. And even once it's established, almost uncoupling that sensitization effect from the control of a behavior. And I think that's a promising line as well. So there's a lot of people working very hard. If the government can give us enough funding so that we can really advance this line of research, then I think we can do a lot of good for, obviously, Canadians, but also smokers worldwide.
Dr. Phillips, it's been a pleasure having you on today.
Well, thank
and,
you
and,
very much.
And I had a lot of other questions for you, but unfortunately we're out of time, but I'd love to have you back on
talk
about this a bit further.
I'd be delighted, and thanks for bringing this show to us.
Thank you very much. All the best to you.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Anthony Phillips, Dr. Tony Phillips, is professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of British Columbia and advisory board member of the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, the Institute of Neurosciences, Mental Health and Addiction, and founding member of Neuroscience Canada. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call.